Could you first tell me, Mr. Winterflood, where and when you were born?
I was born in West Ham in 1937.
Yes. What day?
31st of January, 1937.
And what did your parents do? What did your father do for a living?
My father, I think, originally was a bus conductor.
Yes.
And then when I got to know what life was all about, we had moved to Uxbridge in Middlesex, where my father ran two restaurants. And that's my earliest recollection, really, of what my father did. I only know what he started out through my family.
Yeah. Where did he send you to school?
I went to Fraser College, which was a private school in Uxbridge.
Mm-hmm.
Which I believe now is Bellol. What's that one, the college down in Uxbridge? Can't remember it, but anyway, it's one of those sort of funny new polys, I think. Or something.
Mm. Did you have any plans for what you would do when you'd finished school?
No, I don't think I was terribly good at school, actually, but and we did run into a bit of a problem with, in the latter years, of paying the school fees through upsets in the family.
Mm.
And so when I left school, I didn't know really what I was going to do. And I left before I could complete my my exams because, well, didn't pay the fees. But I spoke to the Latin master at Fraser College, who knew a gentleman on the Stock Exchange by the name of A.K. Barr, who happened to be a partner with the company, the firm called Greener Dreyfus. And A.K. Barr was quite a well-known member of the Stock Exchange who used to specialise in Kaffir shares.
Mm-hmm.
Tanganyika Concessions, I remember, was his pet stock. And he didn't interview me, but I wrote a letter to him, and Greener Dreyfus very kindly offered to give me a job as a messenger.
Mm. Did you know anything about the Stock Exchange?
Nothing at all. Mm. Nothing at all. But I didn't know much about anything, really. I mean, straight from school. And I don't think jobs were terribly easy to get at that stage, so I mean I opted to go to whatever was offered, and it was quite fun running around the Stock Exchange. It was very early morning stuff, getting the workmen's trains, you know, so you got the cheap ticket, and it was a long way from Uxbridge, as I remember, to the city. So it was an early start. I think somehow I've come full circle now, it's a very early start these days, but it was a case of getting in early and running around the city all day, which got one to know what the city was all about, and that went on for a few years, and then one got jobs in the office. But after the initial getting into a firm, you then sort of sorted out what you wanted to do, and there was no doubt that if you were in a stockbroking firm, what you eventually wanted to do, if you're that type of person, was to get down to the house. There was a very big division between the office staff and the house staff. And that was not from the point of view of anything other than you could seem to bring out your own talents if you were on the floor of the Stock Exchange, much more than the sort of humdrum jobs that you would get in the back office. So I did that, and I worked my way up, if you like, to becoming a Blue Button. And that was a thrill. I remember that was a big thrill to be invited to go to the house. And the partners, some of the partners would be on the floor of the house as dealing partners. The mainstay of the business would be upstairs, which was sort of, was rather highbound. I mean, it was a bit off limits to fraternise with the partners. Well, they wouldn't speak to you, I mean, in a case of fraternising. And they were locked away in their sort of ivory towers, and you knocked reverently on the doors if you wanted to see them and things like that. And I do remember it wasn't quite sort of Dickensian, but it wasn't far off.
Mm.
The ones on the floor of the house were much more liberal and reasonable, but nevertheless, there was very much you addressed people as sir, you had a lot of respect for them, and I think good manners were the order of the day. One was very grateful for any promotion you got, but you had to earn it.
Mm.
Pay wasn't terribly good, although I'm not one of these people who can say, oh, I earned 35 shillings a week. I can't remember all that. But all I know is that it wasn't terribly generous. But what was generous was the thrill of getting that bonus at the year end if we'd had a good year. I suppose in today's terms it was quite a meagre amount, but in those days it was a lot of money. And of course it did fire enthusiasm, and you did work jolly hard because there was something at the end of the day, usually. And you could take fairly reasonable holidays and so on. What they didn't do in those days, they very rarely provided for your old age. I mean, one doesn't think of it when you're very young. But people weren't generous about pension schemes and things like that. Mm-hmm. They would carry out their responsibilities by probably putting in the Stock Exchange Clerk's Provident Fund, mm-hmm. Which didn't need much funding. But I think people really took the view that it was a good business to be in, and that you could make a lot of money if you were bright, and that you would look after yourself. Mm-hmm. All in all, I mean, as I remember, my days at doing that were happy days. There was very... they were long days because we didn't have the machinery you have today, and so everything was by long hand, and there was a lot of checking and cross-checking and agreeing positions in the evenings and getting the contracts out and delivering them and getting the post out and so on. So it was a long, long day. Mm. And on top of that, to forward one's career, a lot of us all went to night school for stock exchange practice and so on. And I remember I didn't go to the City of London, I went to the Coleman Street Ward School, which was served very well by members of the Stock Exchange. But there again, it was a case of you did that after hours. You didn't do it as we do now, where we give people time off to go and study. We were expected to attend that from something like 6 till 9 o'clock at night, and you'd get home at sort of 10:30. And so it was a long day. But nevertheless, it was for yourself. You did it. They were reasonably generous, as much they would, or certainly with Greener Drapers, they provided the books for me. And one of the things I always remember, that I didn't get paid an awful lot of money to start with, but they very generously gave me two new suits when I became a Blue Button. I suppose one look back now and think, well, that was small beer, but it wasn't at the time. I mean, it was. I felt immensely grateful to them, because they didn't have to. I mean, they paid me a wage, but it was very nice, and I suppose it helped their image on the floor of the house when I was going in smartly attired and so on. I always remember that. On one occasion, my first occasion of going to the house, it was very wrong to wear anything other than the sort of standard gear. And I remember marching in, full of myself, in brown boots, as they called them, but they were just brown shoes. And of course, I mean, the catcalls went up when I went onto the floor of the house. And really, I mean, one was terribly embarrassed. And I was asked to leave the floor of the house and go and get myself some respectable shoes.
Who asked you?
Black. Oh, members. You know, the waiter took me off. The waiters had certain authority then, you know, that they would be instructed probably by a member to say, oh, what's that chap doing over there in brown boots? Get him out of the house. Mm. And it was just to get black shoes on, really. And I remember that. And, of course, it's all part of growing up. I was frightfully embarrassed at the time. But you look back on it now with, you know, rather a smile on your face and that. Often wish it happened these days. Now there don't seem to be any real rules of anything, of etiquette or standards. And it's a bit sad, the passing of those ways, I think, in lots of ways.
What were you doing as a broker's Blue Button?
Well, it wasn't much removed from what I'd started, actually. You became, yet again, a messenger for the dealers. When the bargains originated from the office down to we had a dealing box just across from the Stock Exchange, with somebody who would write the orders down, which could have been me at the time, or the telephonist if I wasn't there. But then I'd have the responsibility of taking those to find a dealer, waiting with the dealer if he asked me to go with him, but more often than not asked to wait at the stand, because unless you were a dealer, you were not expected to roam around the Stock Exchange. You were expected to stand on the outside of the perimeter, because it was crowded anyhow. But if the dealer wanted to go with him, I mean, once you were with him, it was perfectly all right. But if you were just strolling around, they didn't have time for that. And then he would execute the bargain, give it to you. You would then rush it back to the box and report it and enter it probably onto a bargain slip. And that would go out to the office to be processed. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was about. And of course, the hours of business then, I think, were 9:30 to 3:30. Mm-hmm. And then you did the same sort of thing up in the office, although you were helping the dealer on the telephone. Mm-hmm. A general dog's body, really, early days of a Blue Button.
How did the Stock Exchange strike you as a young Blue Button? Do you have any particular memories of
that? I do, actually. I mean, some of the things, it's peculiar how things stick in your mind, but when I think back to the Stock Exchange, I always remember the street. I remember Throgmorton Street very well, and how
what a wonderful street it was, you know, what the atmosphere of people rushing in and rushing out, and the steps going up to the Stock Exchange, you know, it was a very sort of rather ugly building from the outside, rather grand inside. And I remember sort of rushing across the road, and in those days they did have traffic. I mean, people were sort of jumping in and out of things, and there was lots of people sort of standing on street corners. And just along from our box was a little chemist where the sort of the gay dogs of the day would be going in the morning for a pick-me-up, and they used to have this terrible concoction that was a bit like a Dracula potion, you know, for a pick-me-up the next day. I mean, not that I would, but you saw them going in, and you looked at these chaps, and they were all nicely attired. They'd been out for the night and so on, and they'd have their pick-me-up. And I remember particularly going into the floor, or going up the stairs to the entrance that I used to use, and they had great long trays for cigarette ends. Everybody smoked then, I mean, it was ridiculous. But you would come in, and you weren't allowed to smoke on the floor, so as you got in, you'd either put them on these ledges, and all these cigarettes burning, that'd be awful, although I smoked at the time, actually. And lots would be thrown into the bin. And what I remember so well was you had these chaps, beggars or tramps, if you like, would come in and they would take these cigarettes out of the trays and roll their own. And sometimes they'd pick out bundles, but it was still smouldering. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. But I do remember very well these chaps. Mm. Or every day coming, and the waiter would put perhaps a tray downstairs to get ready to empty it. Mm. And these chaps would take all these cigarettes out. And another sort of image I remember was the loos that we had in there. I mean, there were no women, of course, so it was all male. But they were very grand loos. I always remember they were grand loos, you know, the great oak doors, and it had Stock Exchange soap in the wash basins, and had Stock Exchange on it, and brushes for your hair that was embossed with Stock Exchange things. And the chap in charge was really the sort of, I mean, he was in charge. The man that ran the loos was there, and you behaved yourself, and there was no graffiti or anything like that. Nobody stole anything, you know. And you respected the property. And if you didn't, he'd have given you a clip round the ear. But he was all important, this man. He had a lot of authority. Although he only ran the loo, he was the man. And I remember that very well, you know. And I think I do remember sort of being tempted that wouldn't it be nice to have a memento? And I don't suppose anyone would have cared if you had a bar of soap, but you didn't do it. And they're sort of really vivid memories of just the entrance to the place. And I remember sort of strolling off to the offices of the Council of the Stock Exchange, if you like, and that was in the next door, and it was all very proper, and you sort of made sure that you conducted yourself in the right way. There was never any of this sort of casualness that we have today. Perhaps it was slower, I don't know, but certainly one had a pride in the place and your job and the people, really. I mean, one had sort of respect for them. And my memories are all very good of my young days up in the Stock Exchange. There were nasty people, of course. I mean, I remember various people who were intolerable. I mean, absolutely awful. But they treated you as the dog's body, and you had to earn their respect and to grow and find your way. I mean, there was one particular man called Percy Duke. And Percy Duke was really the old school, and he was a jobber. And he would stand in between the industrial market and not far from the gilt market and the ship's market. And he'd have this little picture, very small company. But he always dressed in clerical trousers and wing collar. And he was a very tall man and a lot of bearing, and he would never speak to blue buttons. And I'm not sure that he really spoke to junior dealers, but certainly you almost had to sort of get permission to speak to him. And he had his dealers, but he was very much the kingpin with the firm. And he had, if I could tell a little story about this man, he had this this air about him that you really had to pluck up a lot of courage to go and speak to him. And when you were dealing in the stocks and shares in the stock market, people would go around to various jobbers to get a price. And Percy Duke was always credited with the one chap that tried to find out what you'd doing or had done or wanted to do, and what the other chap was making the price. Because it wasn't like today, you all made your own prices. They were very much in line, but you all made your own. And so he was always the one that, when he say, if you go to Percy Duke, he'll always try and open you for nothing. which means that you tell him your business and he wouldn't be dealing. And there was this classic story of the young fellow that went up to him who'd been authorised, and Percy Duke sort of ignored him, and the chap sort of followed around until he got his attention. And finally he said to Mr. Duke, excuse me, sir, can you tell me the time? And he said, would you find it elsewhere? And, you know, that was the sort of stories that, they were real. They were real. I mean, it did happen. And I remember with him that, I mean, he just ignored me completely when I went to speak to him. And you just couldn't speak to him, so you had to go and get the dealer. Because sometimes if the dealers were busy, they'd say, go and get me a price in so-and-so, or go and get me a price in opinion. And Blue Bunts were allowed to do that. They weren't allowed to deal, but they were allowed to ask variously. They couldn't ask sizes or things like that. They could just ask about the price of the stock and what it did and if there was an opinion. They couldn't say how many is that in. Weren't allowed to do that. And so most of the day was spent avoiding people like Mr. Duke, staying on the outside in the very early days, and just generally doing what was expected of you. But one of the other things I remember very vividly is that come 3 o'clock, you were allowed to smoke. You couldn't smoke during the day, and that's consequently why everybody smoked in the corridors and at the entrances. But at 3 o'clock, you were allowed to smoke, and they used to have, the waiters would walk round, and there were stands everywhere and jobbers' pitches, and the waiters would walk round with water cans at 3 o'clock, and they would be watering the floor in between all the members. They rarely got water on anybody's shoes, I can assure you, but they were just ordinary watering cans, and that was to keep the dust down. It was quite an extraordinary thing. And every day this happened. I mean, it was dusty, it was a wooden floor. And every day, as I say, they came out with their water cans and damped the floor down. Mm. Quite extraordinary. Mm. Well, they did it without wetting anybody.
As a broker's Blue Button, did you have any contact with the jobbers?
Well, as I say, you could ask them a price, you could ask them an opinion, but you couldn't ask them size. So, yes, one knew them all, and one knew who dealt in which markets, but you were only a messenger as a Blue Button. That's all you could do. Obviously, one got to know them as friends, and one could ask those friends off the record things, but if the senior partners saw you hanging around on the pitch, they'd ask you to go. I mean, they'd give their own chaps a rocket as well. One of the other main jobs you had as a Blue Button is every morning you'd go in and you'd see if there are any notes at your stand. We all had a number, and the waiter would keep notes, and they may be bids or offers, or they may be messages to go and see somebody. And then when the market opened, or just before it opened actually, the Blue Buttons were in, and they would go around to all of the jobbers who in those days used to print daily lists, price lists. And particularly with some of the big boys in those days, Francis and Praed was a very big firm of gilt edge jobbers, and they used to do every day a beautiful list of prices, yields to redemption, covers, and so on. And that was really necessary reading, and you got that and you sent that off either to some of your clients or you got on the telephone. But every day these beautiful lists would come out. And it was like collecting the sort of thing you collect at the daily at the Ideal Home Show. You know, you come home with a bag full of papers, don't you, and offers and things like that. And it was just like that. They're all colours. I mean, Francis and Praise, I remember, was a sort of a green. Some of them were. Sanborn's was orange. No, red, pink, reddish pink. Some of the others were yellow, some were sort of blue. It was quite extraordinary, and in the end, of course, being very young, you sort of get them in the order you want, and we had them in sort of coloured order, if you like, and it was you'd come away with a pile like that every morning. I mean, it must have cost a fortune to produce them. But of course it saved the brokers an immense amount of work, and it bought those jobbers a certain amount of business because theirs were the information. You know, it was a service that cost nothing, but proved very positive at the end of the day to the brokers, to the jobbers who provided it.
Were there particular jobbing firms that Greener and Dreyfus did a lot of business with? For example, particular jobbers in the cafes?
Well, yes, I think Lazarus was one. Mm. Lauren Roos was another. Mm. Lazarus I remember very well. I mean, one was always over there. AK Barr was always over there. Berger Gustschalk were another one. But George Lazarus was a big character. You know, he would be the one that did open outcry. I mean, he would be shouting at the top of his head, "Bid so-and-so for tanks, offer Katangas at so-and-so," you know. And very loud. I mean, he sort of held the stage. There were lots of jobbers, but we were very big in the Kaffir market. And the other market that AK Bar particularly liked was breweries. I always remember lots of business in Boddington's, Whitbread's, Green or Whitley. A lot of the provincial breweries and things like that. And fairly general business in industrials, tobacco shares was one that featured a lot. And a certain amount of business in all the other markets. I mean, they had a bit of business in gilts, they had a bit of business in the oils, they had a bit of business in shipping. I don't remember particularly much in the insurance world. Mm. A lot in the industrial generally. Some rubber business. There was still a reasonable amount of rubber business going on. Fairly general business, I think, but Kaffirs particularly and breweries. Mm. They were two special.
How did it rate as a broking house? Was it medium size?
It was quite small, actually. A very much specialised smaller company. Quite a number of partners, as I remember, but I mean, they were a small company compared to the others. Mm. I suppose, really, it was only in later years that Green and Dreyfus started to grow. It acquired other companies, and then, strangely enough, it went the full circle and disappeared. People had a very nice living, you know, as brokers. I mean, they made vast amounts of money. They had, I mean, it was, if they had some sort of connections through birth, it was like shelling peas, really. I mean, people just gave them their business. There was no capital gains tax. There was no surveillance. There was an enormous amount of inside trading. There was very much the old Pals Act, you know. Would you like 50 of these, John, or we'll put you down for a tenner? I mean, jobbers and brokers used to sort of tell each other things. And, I mean, there were all these stories that, you know, one particular rubber jobber was, well, it was one for the book and one for me sort of thing, you know. And the rip-offs were really extraordinary. But everybody made a lot of money because there's no tax to be paid, you know. It was a different world, but it was a world apart. I mean, it was the city, and it was the people connected with the city, and it was the families that had wealth. There were no SIDs then. I mean, that didn't come into the equation. In fact, the reason I changed over the fence was I tried awfully hard to get myself some clients. But actually, I mean, I just wasn't born into the right family. I wasn't born into the right area. It was an impossible task. And the people that I would speak to about stocks and shares would be people that would expect to make a lot of money, wouldn't expect to spend very much money, would expect to be on call all the time. In fact, there was just no turning. And so finally, that's why I changed over to jobbing, because you could work for yourself almost.
Well, how did your career with Greener Dreyfus unfold before you switched to jobbing? Did you remain a Blue Button?
I remained a Blue Button, and then my career was interrupted by National Service. So that was in 50, I don't know, I'll give you those dates, yes. I've got them in my diary. Yes. But anyway, it was when I became 18, and so I'd done just over sort of 2 years with the Greeners.
So you'd started with him around 19...
Whenever I was 15, what am I now, 53?
So about, if you're born 37, it was about 1952?
53, I think 53, it was.
53, right, eh?
And so that interrupted my career, and they were, went off to National Service, and that was that. And I did my 2 years, and of course they were very nice and said, when you finish that, do come back and see us. And there were no promises, but you know, we'd like to see you, and we'd like you to do your job again, and so on. Well, of course, things changed a lot in 2 years, and I wanted to come back. I mean, I sort of got the I'd got the feeling that this was the right job for me, anyhow. And I do remember just before I went, or was it my return? No, I think it was before I went in. I remember speaking to a chap who was a little bit older than me, rather dapper sort of bloke, and done rather well as a broker, although it wasn't of any particular social status, but he'd done rather well. And I always remember him saying to me, because I was a bit fed up not knowing what I wanted to do and not making up my mind, because you work long hours, you know. I mean, it was pretty harrowing stuff. And, you know, some days you think, oh, Christ, this is terrible, you know, I'm working all hours, God sends me, I've got no time for my girlfriends, and so on and so forth. And I said to this chap, you know, I'm not too sure about this, I don't think this is, I'm not sure this is what I want to do in my life. And he said, well, you just look round. And he said, I think you'll find that all the people you know here have a pretty good standard of living. And all of the people down in this stock exchange, not many of them you will find over the years, go away. And I can tell you that you will do better here in monetary terms than you will anywhere else. Well, that was a pretty large order. But what I think he meant was if you were working in the back office or if you were working in any other sort of jobs locally. I don't think he meant Lloyd's. I don't think he meant the Baltic and things like that. But in the context of the stock exchange, we were in the best place. Anyhow, that always stayed with me. And I remember when I came out of the services that I was very happy to go back to the stock exchange. Lots of people were going back to their old jobs. Some people said they were fed up with it. These were mates of mine in the Air Force. And so I did go back to the old firm. And when I went in to replace me, they had brought in a chap called Charlie Wilson. And he was the Honourable Charles Wilson. And when I came out, Charlie became, I don't know why Charlie, whether he did National Service or what, but anyway, he was a little bit older than me. Not a great deal older than me, a little bit older than me. And when I came out, Charlie was a partner, and they expected me to be the blue one. Well, fair dues, I didn't mean that. And Charlie, of course, was my boss. And I was a bit upset about that. I thought, damn cheek, really. But nevertheless, he was in there, and he was doing his job and so on. And I quite liked the bloke, actually. But they wanted me to be blue button, general dog's body, this, that and the other. Well, it was all right when you were 16, 17. It wasn't quite the same thing when you were 20, 21. And I sort of took umbrage to this. And I said, well, I don't think I like this too much. You know, I'll give it a go. And I don't mind being blue button for 6 months. But certainly, I'm not going to spend my life being blue button. And they said, well, it's entirely up to you. You know, jobs weren't terribly free. So I studied for a while. And then I said, well, I don't think this is going to suit me. And I remember Reggie Barrett, who was Reggie was a senior member. He finally became a partner, but he was a man that he knew everything. I mean, he really was jack of all trades, master of none, because he was like the faithful retainer, really. And I know now that they exploited him. They abused his honesty and his integrity and his just regard for them, you know, and he never sort of got anywhere, but he was their senior dealer. He was extremely good. He taught me everything I knew, and he, I wouldn't say encouraged me to leave, but he said, you know, you've got to spread your wings. There are other things. I don't want to lose you, but, you know, you may not get on too well here now because everything's in place. You've been away for 2 years. So I stuck it for a while, and then I decided that I wasn't going to get any clients, and that's why I decided to go across to the other side of the business. And there was a job going, and I got interviewed, and that really was a bit of a shambles. But and I suppose it's the way I always think people in life have a lucky break, and mine was certainly that, because the waiter, one of these waiters, very friendly guy, he always knew me as Peter. He never knew my name was Brian, and to the day he retired, he called me Peter, and one couldn't change it because we're not talking to him. But anyhow, he put me on to Bisgal Bishop, who were looking for people. And I said, all right, I'd like to do that. So he put me on, and I got myself an interview. And it was, I don't know, there were quite a lot of people going for the interview, and I got onto the shortlist. And I told Reggie Barrett, and he was quite pleased for me. He said, you know, it's a different way of life over there. It's not really what you're doing here. You've got to you've got to stand there all day, and you've got to book the bargain. You've got to do this, you've got to do this very fast. And so on. He said, but you do have a chance of making your own way. So anyhow, I got finally got the job after, although I say it myself, there were a lot of people on this list, and I was very fortunate, and I felt rather cock-a-hoop because I'd actually got the job out of all these people. So I joined them, and I said my farewells to the old firm and thanked them for all they'd done for me and so on, and they didn't want to lose me, as I remember, but I said, well, I'm not going to make anything here. It's not going to be my future. So I went off to Bisgood, and Harry Bishop was the senior partner, and he was an old colonel, and he was very military, and one didn't actually spend much time speaking to him. Anyhow, I joined, And I was with a man called Howard Taylor, who was the second partner. And he was a tyrant. He was a most awful man. He had no patience. He was foul-mouthed. He was more interested in the races every day, and he spent his lunch hour in one of the telephone boxes onto his bookie. He saw very little good in anything. He'd had a very upsetting life himself. His son got killed in a train crash, I think. His wife ran off with somebody. I mean, it was rather nasty background, but it manifested itself in his behaviour towards other people. And so I was with him, and he really did kick you around. And I decided, I mean, almost, talk about first impressions wrong, after the first week that I couldn't stand this, that this was a nightmare. I was getting in, you know, at sort of 7:30 in the morning, and we were working till sort of 8 o'clock at night trying to agree positions. And then I had no time to myself at all. It really was a nightmare, and I hated every minute. And I thought, God, this is terrible. Anyhow, after a week, I went back to my old firm to get my job back, you see. And I remember perspiring. I remember being sort of sweaty, running from the stock exchange up to this office and negotiating with these people and saying a little bit of naughtiness about what I was going to get and what I wasn't going to get. Anyway, they offered to give me my job back. And they said, okay, you can come back. You get the same salary. And I was, you know, I was quite content with that. And as time went on,